Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about healthcare in America and looking at the history of the HMO, the Health Maintenance Organization. In the early 1970s, the federal government supported the development of HMOs, and the hope was that these would do a number of things, that they would help slow down the ever-increasing cost of healthcare, that they would increase access to healthcare, and overall, it would help the nation be healthier. And it turned out that that didn't quite work that way. And in fact, as we know now, healthcare as a portion of America's gross domestic product has more than doubled over the last 30 years. And rising costs have left something like 45 million Americans without any kind of health insurance. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Jan Coombs. She's a medical historian who lives near Madison, Wisconsin. And she is the author of a book that's titled The Rise and Fall of HMOs. The subtitle is An American Healthcare Revolution. It is published by the University of Wisconsin Press. And the book tries to do a couple of things, to talk a little bit about the HMO and put it in its historical context, look at it, what the idea was back at the beginning, if you can actually remember the time when HMO was a new idea, what the intent was and how it is that it didn't quite work out that way. And it also takes a look by way of a case study at one HMO in particular, an early one. This was the Marshfield Clinic in northern Wisconsin. As we talk, certainly, questions are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So here again in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Either of those numbers, whichever works for you. Certainly questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. All we ask is people are brief. Just be brief so that we can get as many in as possible and keep moving along. But of course, questions and comments from listeners are certainly welcome. Ms. Coombs, hello.
Hello. I'm glad to be on your show.
Well, I certainly appreciate your giving us some of your time. Maybe to start out, as I said, I think now probably a lot of people who are listening to us, because here at the university we get our health care, a lot of people listening to us are in HMOs. It's hard to imagine going back to this point in the 1970s when this was a brand new concept. Maybe you could just set the stage a little bit and talk about at that point what was the health insurance, what did the health insurance landscape look like?
Well, David, back in the 1970s, when I first started to write this or think about writing this book, there were very few HMOs, and people just didn't know what they were. In fact, the name HMO really didn't come into being until President Nixon decided that he needed some sort of a government policy to improve health care in the United States. Up until that time, most people in the United States who were under 65 and who were working had a fairly good insurance policy to cover their health care. Another one of the things, one of the circumstances of that time was that health care wasn't very expensive. So most working people had health care. But a lot of people who weren't working didn't have it. Certainly farmers and other poor people didn't have it. And the senior citizens didn't have health care. So in 1965, thanks to President Johnson, the United States passed some very significant Social Security legislation that gave health care benefits to American senior citizens through Medicare, and gave the states the ability to finance health care for the poor through Medicaid. And all of a sudden, there was this great demand for medical care across the country. And a health care crisis developed because the doctors took advantage of the generous reimbursements from the federal programs. Prices started to go up, and there weren't enough health care providers to provide all the health care that was needed for these two new populations of citizens. So that's how things started out.
Uh-huh. How was it that the federal government decided to pass this, to create this, the Health Maintenance Organization Act? This was in the early 1970s, and it took it took a couple of years.
Well, it took 3 years, actually. What happened was that there were all kinds of organizations, labor unions, and all kinds of people screaming for the federal government to do something to cut down the cost of the rising cost of medical care, as you mentioned earlier, provide better access to people, and also improve the quality of the care that was being given. And the Democrats, led by Senator Ted Kennedy, wanted to have universal health care, much like they have in all of the Western industrialized countries in the world. And so he was promoting universal health care along with the unions. And the Republicans decided that they had to come up with something that would respond to Kennedy's proposal, because they didn't want to have universal health care. So the Nixon administration, some of the people in the Nixon administration, met with some people from Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente was a prepaid health care plan that was well known to some people around the country. It was very popular on the West Coast, and it was known for providing good access, good care at lower cost. And so when a representative from the Nixon administration met with someone from the Kaiser Foundation, they coined the term Health Maintenance Organization and decided to build a legislative proposal around that the government would fund. So for 3 years, the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress haggled over which they were going to do, move towards universal health care or move towards government-sponsored development of HMOs.
I think that's interesting to note that this some of these concerns that we think of as being perhaps a bit more recent, concerns about access to care, concerns about increasing costs, the question of whether or not it would be possible or appropriate to provide some kind of universal care, what the government involvement should be, how much of this should be a sort of a private sector effort, all of those kinds of things that we're still debating now, and it seems like we've been debating for some time, they at least go all the way back to the early 1970s.
Well, they go back, actually, to the 1930s, when President Roosevelt was trying to get in passage of the original Social Security Act. And he wanted to include in that health care for everyone. And the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, and a lot of other health care providers saw to it that health care was not included in the original Social Security legislation. But President Truman tried to introduce universal health care, and lots of other presidents ever since then have been trying to introduce that without any success at all. And I think that part of this is due to the feeling in the United States that we have such good business people and such an entrepreneurial spirit that we should be able to do it through business, not through government. And actually, President Nixon's bill did pass and provide money for HMO development, but it was an absolute failure because very few people wanted to contend with all the restrictions that that bill put on HMOs. They had to file enormous amounts of paperwork, and there were many restrictions that a lot of healthcare providers didn't want to get involved in.
And was that simply that there were in this 3-year argument about just how this thing would be organized, that there were a lot of different people, there were a lot of competing interests?
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't that you talked about the fact that actually maybe the Republicans and President Nixon really weren't all that thrilled about the idea in the first place, that the reason that you get such a tangled, complicated system didn't have so much to do with lack of enthusiasm among Republicans as it was, well, there were just a lot of interests here that were all competing and needed to be balanced or satisfied.
Well, that's right. Although I think in the beginning, when President Nixon first introduced the HMO Act, he really did feel that this was something that would work in this country. But there were so many competing interests, as you said. And by the second term of his, when he ran for his second term, the AMA was so opposed to any HMO legislation that they mounted a vast campaign with lots and lots of money, led by his former personal physician, to encourage him to drop most of the provisions that were helpful in the HMO Act. And so the final legislation was really watered down in terms of what it would provide, and it also was heavily burdened by a lot of mandates that the Democrats had imposed because they didn't want doctors trying to fudge the system and not provide the kinds of care that they thought patients should have.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, during the 3 years while Congress was debating the HMO Act, there were a lot of HMOs that were started around the country. And Marshfield Clinic was one of them in Wisconsin. It was the first one to start an HMO in Wisconsin. And these HMOs were really quite successful. They did it without any government help. But during the 4 years after HMO legislation was passed, there were fewer HMOs started than before the legislation was passed.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jan Coombs. She is a medical historian, and she is the author of the book, The Rise and Fall of HMOs, An American Healthcare Revolution. This book is published by the University of Wisconsin Press. And the book takes a look at the development of the concept of the HMO and about what it was intended to be, or at least the hope about the HMO at the beginning, and about how it turned out that it didn't quite work the way that it had been hoped. At least people who argued for the concept of the health maintenance organization right at the beginning said that it would be a way to try to bring down costs of health care, increase access, and overall improve health. And it seems that to date, none of those things really have happened, at least not to the satisfaction of all of us. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Perhaps you could, again, talk a little bit about the basic idea of the HMO and how that was different from the health insurance that existed at the time. You know, what the big differences were, and I suppose that indeed would have been the key to why it was that perhaps physicians and physician organizations weren't real hot on the concept, at least not initially.
Right. Well, insurance companies before HMOs would pay for care, and they would pay for any care that the doctors provided for their patients. And there were no controls established and in terms of what doctors could do or what they couldn't do. HMOs were an organization that collected monthly premiums, just like insurance companies did, but they also had a staff of doctors or worked with a group of doctors and paid them a set sum regardless of what care they provided. And the idea was that doctors would try to be cost-conscious about controlling the care that they gave the patients. They didn't, Kaiser Permanente, for example, didn't say, well, you know, we're trying to save so much money that we want you to stint on care. They just said, we want you to be very cost-conscious. And they also, HMOs, many times would hire paraprofessionals like nurse practitioners or physician assistants to help the doctor so that there wasn't so much doctor time spent, but these other paraprofessionals could spend a lot of time working with patients to help them understand what their treatments were and why they should be following them. So there was a lot of emphasis given to providing excellent care but controlling costs. And this is one of the things that people were afraid of, that the doctors would control costs so much that they wouldn't be giving good care. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think certainly that was that's a central feature. Maybe it's the essential feature of the idea rather than the service being provided and then somebody coming along afterwards and simply paying for it, the idea was that there to be some sort of upfront consideration of the patient, what the patient needed, and then somebody making a decision whether or not service would be provided. And then I think also ideally there was also a wellness component that was supposed to be part of this too.
Right.
That the idea was that if we could persuade people to be more healthy, if we were a little bit more proactive, then in that case, maybe we might be spending money up front on the person's health, but then in the long run, we would keep them healthier. And so actually, overall, over the course of the person's life, we would actually be spending less money.
Well, you said that much better than I did. But prevention was a very important part of the HMO concept. And also, the HMOs encouraged people to come in when they first got sick and come in to see their doctors rather than waiting until they were so sick that they needed hospitalization, so that there was a real emphasis put on outpatient care versus hospital care, which is much more expensive for HMOs.
I suppose that the answer to the question why it is that the cost of health care has continued to go up so dramatically is complicated, and I suppose just something like instituting this kind of health plan for providing health coverage might not have been sufficient to really curtail the increasing costs, but you would have to ask the question, well, if that was the intention of the HMO at the beginning, why is it that it wasn't more effective? Why didn't it make more of a contribution to trying to get at the issue of rising cost of health care?
David, the whole concept of HMO care, which we now call managed care, is a very good concept. And it would work, and it still does work in some parts of the country where we have nonprofit HMOs operating. But what happened was that during the Reagan administration, his administration decided that the HMO Act wasn't working with federal assistance. So the Reagan administration encouraged private insurance companies to get involved in HMO development. And so during the middle of the 1880s and into the 1980s and 1990s, we saw an enormous development of for-profit healthcare organizations that copied the concepts of HMOs, but raised the cost of administration costs of the healthcare. Then in the early 1990s and later, we saw a lot of mergers of for-profit HMOs to the point where today there are only a handful of large multi-state for-profit HMOs or health insurance plans that cover 80% of the people with insurance. These plans use between 20 and 30% of the healthcare dollars that they take in premiums for administrative costs. They have clerical staff that spend hours and hours controlling how doctors can treat patients in the various policies that these patients have. They give their CEOs, I think, obscene salaries of multi-million dollar salaries, yearly salaries with stock options. And they have to, in order to give their investors money, they deny people who are chronically ill and have a lot, will need a lot of health care. They deny those people admission into their health plan. So one of the things that, one of the reasons that health care costs have gone up so fast is that the administrative costs for these for-profit health care plans is responsible. Just to give you one example, since 1970, the number of doctors and nurses in this country have barely increased over the last 35 or 40 years. But the number of clerical workers or administrative workers in the healthcare industry has increased 2,500%. And that accounts for a lot of the healthcare money that is being wasted in this country.
So it's pretty clear here, obviously, that you, it is your feeling that if you ask this question, why is it that the health maintenance organization did not fulfill its initial promise, particularly when it comes to, well, when it comes to both access and comes to cost control, your answer to that question is the increasing number of HMOs that are for profit.
That's right.
Your answer to that question would be yes, that's a significant problem, and perhaps if now most of the HMOs or all of the HMOs were nonprofits, that things would have worked out differently?
Yes, they would have. The other thing that's happened, and if you want to talk about why healthcare costs are increasing, mm-hmm. We can talk about the population getting older or drugs getting more expensive or there's more equipment that doctors can use. But the other major reason why healthcare cost is increasing in this country is that when insurance companies deny care to the people who are sick, these people, and we now have, instead of 45 million people uninsured when I finished writing the book, we now have 46.6 million people who are uninsured. When they get sick, they wait until they're very sick. They usually, because they don't have a doctor, go to emergency rooms for treatment. They usually often require hospitalization. Any care that you get in the hospital is expensive. Emergency room care is expensive. Hospitalization is very expensive. In order to recover these costs, the doctors who work in the hospitals, and the hospitals themselves have to raise their fees. When they raise their fees, the insurance companies have to raise their premiums. So all across the country, insurance companies are raising their premiums in an effort to compensate doctors who are treating people who are uninsured. So it's a vicious cycle. And what happens is that employers now can't afford to pay the full cost of employee coverage, so they're making their employees pay part of their premium costs. They're making them pay high deductibles and co-pays, or they're not insuring their employees anymore. So we get more people who are uninsured, who have to wait to get emergency room care, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse.
We are just a little bit past the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. We have some calls coming in, and I would like to introduce again our guest for this hour, Jan Coombs. She is a medical historian. She lives near Madison, Wisconsin, and we are talking about her book, The Rise and Fall of HMOs, An American Healthcare Revolution. That's the subtitle. The book is published by the University of Wisconsin Press and takes a bit of a look at the history of the HMO going back to the early 1970s, when the idea was that these organizations, health maintenance organizations, would help to control costs of care and would increase access to care. And the book perhaps tries to supply an answer to the question, why is it that that really didn't happen? Questions are certainly welcome, and we have several. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to join us. We do also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And there are several callers here that are ready to go. We'll take them in just in the order they came in, starting first with someone here locally, Champaign-Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, comment on the seniors who go overseas and get treatment or pills, and they pay for their vacation with the savings, and locally there's people who want to correct the donut hole in Medicare, and for the first time a health plan sent people overseas, and they saved 90%, 90, and split the difference or a little with the patient.
That's becoming something that is has gained favor among a lot of employers, especially those who self-insure their own employees. And what they're doing is they look around to see how much a hip replacement costs in their area, and they might find that it costs $15,000 or $20,000 to have it done right near where their workers live. But they can send that worker over to India, for example, and get a hip replaced for $5,000. So they pay for the employer, the worker, and his family to go over to India. They give them, you know, good hotels. They pay them a bonus. And so far, this seems to be working quite well. I would hope that the American medical institutions, the hospitals, would begin to realize that perhaps they should try and lower costs to make them more competitive. It's so far there haven't been any problems with people incurring any bad infections or anything, but I would hate to see this become a very popular trend.
All right, well, let us continue here. We'll talk with someone else. And the next caller in line is in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting program. There was a program on PBS about a community, I forget whether it was just one hospital or a combination, and it was in the Southwest, maybe California, I don't remember. But they were being inundated and overwhelmed with diabetes problems. And so they took a proactive stance using temporary funding and set about having nurses or nursing assistants working with individuals about lowering their weight and managing their diabetes, and so that they would not end up in the hospital in the first place. But they weren't. It wasn't clear whether the funding was going to continue, because it's more spectacular and more definite to treat somebody once they're in the hospital than to prevent the diabetes. And it seems to me that we have that kind of attitude individually ourselves and in how we reimburse for medical care. We don't apparently reimburse doctors who are geriatricians to help keep people out of nursing homes, keep people healthy. We don't ourselves seem to watch our weight, exercise, stop smoking. We seem to think that medicine is going to give us a new knee or a new hip, and that if it's going to cure our problems that we've created from smoking, whether it's impotence with Viagra or back problems or not only to mention cancer and emphysema, I think we really have unrealistic expectations of what medicine can do for ourselves versus what we can do to prevent the problems in the first place. And I think that's probably human nature. I don't know how you overcome the human nature. Speaking as somebody who could lose a few pounds herself, but I'm working on it. Because I look at people a few years older than myself, and I see knee and hip replacements, and I think, and they're all overweight. Or I see back problems, and they're all overweight. And I think to myself, I don't want to do that.
Right.
So I don't know how one changes that. It seems to be human nature to take the easy way out. It's easier to take a pill or to have the surgery and have somebody else pay for it than it is to lose the weight. It is hard to lose weight. It's hard to stop smoking. Any thoughts about this? But it seems to me that this is a big problem in dealing and getting and not spending money on health care that could to solve problems that we could have prevented ourselves in the first place.
Well, I think you've brought up two very good issues, and one is we need more education, good education, and good motivation to encourage people to take care of themselves, to get out and exercise, and stop smoking, and stop drinking so much. A lot of healthcare reform have tied this kind of motivation to reducing the premium costs on people who lose weight, or if you're in a program and you want to lose weight and or stop smoking, they will pay for your you to attend classes and, you know, stop smoking or lose weight or whatever. You know, that's one whole area that needs a lot more work. One of the other areas that you mentioned is this whole business of caring for chronically ill patients, and diabetes is one of them. Chronic heart failure is another. There's a lot of problems that older people encounter, and if these problems are carefully monitored through their health care system, then these people end up spending a lot less time in the hospitals. They end up leading much healthier lives. And I'm working right now in Wisconsin on a health care bill that would insure all the people in the state. And part of this health care bill would involve having patient advocates or 24-hour 7 nurses or physician's assistants or some kind of nurses helping, monitoring these people very, very carefully so that they stay out of trouble. And when you do this, when you help people stay out of trouble by carefully monitoring their chronic illnesses, you save a tremendous amount of money. And we're counting on those kinds of savings to be able to help us afford to insure everyone in the state?
There seems to also be this attitude, particularly with issues regarding the smoking, that no one should tell anybody else what to do, and it's the nanny state if you try to deal with that. So in our two cities, in Urbana and Champaign, we have a smoking ban that's going into in effect in steps. And we've got a mayor who's a smoker and who says, you know, you shouldn't be telling people what to do. And yet when he developed lung cancer last year, I'm sure he didn't pay for it himself. I'm sure that he charged his insurance company for that, and the rest of us paid for his lung cancer. I'd like to see some sticks as well as some carrots that say, mm-hmm. okay, you want to smoke? This is my fantasy. I don't know. I'm sure that nobody would go for it. But if you want to smoke, I want you to sign something here that says, I will not seek treatment for my self-induced problems caused by smoking, or either that or I'll pay for them myself.
Well, the other thing that some insurance companies do is charge you more if you do smoke. But if you look at some of the literature that's out on smoking, it turns out that people pay so much in health care taxes. I mean, in taxes for cigarettes and other tobacco products, and they die so early because they use all these products that actually we make money on them because they die early. That's a very crass way of looking at it, but the taxes more than pay for the care that people who get lung cancer have when they die.
I'm going to jump in here. I'll again hope the caller wouldn't mind because I have a couple of others and about 10 minutes left. And I do also want to introduce once again our guest for this hour of Focus, Jan Coombs. She's a medical historian. She lives near Madison, Wisconsin. She is the author of the book, The Rise and Fall of HMOs. It takes a look at the history of the concept of the Health Maintenance Organization and also profiles one in particular, a clinic located in rural Wisconsin, the Marshfield Clinic, where they set up a health plan, and it actually predated the creation of the HMO Act. So she uses that as a case study of how things can work or some of the difficulties that organizations like this have faced. So if you're interested in learning more on the subject, you look for the book. Questions are welcome, too. We have a couple of people who are ready to go. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign and line 3. Hello.
Hi. Is a managed care company, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Now, it seems like the newest ploy is, and to me, the pharmaceutical thing or the Medicare Part D is sort of a joke or a disaster or whatever. But they're tying in, managed care that for so much to get you into the system is that I think if at a certain level or somewhere that your prescriptions may be taken care of or something or other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But again, this is a for-profit, and I think it's being encouraged by the government. I think that, in fact, the Medicare Part D was certainly encouraged by the government, and I don't know exactly how it's funded, but there's a... But one of the big players is Humana, and I'm not sure if they're going to, how well they're going to serve the public, from that standpoint. I know that the criticism of the, the HMOs in the past was that he had a primary physician, and he or she is the one that determined whether you're going to have something done or whether you were going to go on to somebody else. And I think sometimes, too, is that the specialists that they had, there was some criticism that, they weren't the best, the most competent. And so once you had one that wasn't very good or, you couldn't get a change. Was that correct?
I can't answer specifically for Humana.
Okay.
But I do want to address two things that you've brought up.
Sure.
One is the use of primary care physicians.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is this whole issue of what Humana and other insurance companies have done with Medicare, and it's called Medicare Advantage.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Let me talk about primary care.
Sure. I'll just sign off and listen.
Okay. Primary care physicians are promoted by HMOs, private HMOs and for-profit HMOs. And the goal of the primary care physician is to coordinate patient care, to make sure that everything that's being done is being done for you in the right way. Usually, HMOs ask that the primary care physicians also be called what are called gatekeepers. And that means that if you need the care of a specialist, they're supposed to be able to decide whether you need that care and then make a referral. Most patients, if they have a serious problem and need to see a specialist, they may not know whether they need to go to a neurologist or an orthopedist, or they might be able to tell whether they need to go to a gynecologist or a dentist, but but you know, most patients don't understand what the various specialties do or how they could handle their illness. So the idea of primary care physicians coordinating care and making the right kinds of referrals to specialists is very good. Whether an insurance company has good specialists on its staff is, you know, another problem. And some of them have very good specialists that they can contact, and others don't. As far as Advantage, Medicare Advantage, that was a program that was passed by Congress along with Medicare Part D in 2005. And I strongly object to both of those programs, and I make a case for my objections in my book. First of all, because the whole intent was to get more Medicare beneficiaries into HMOs, usually for-profit ones. And the federal government actually paid these HMOs so much money that they hardly needed to charge anything, if anything at all, for their Medicare beneficiaries to join the HMOs. This part of the program has cost our federal government millions and millions of extra dollars. And this is the government that says that we don't have enough money to support Medicare and that we're going to have to start, you know, doing means testing to see who can afford to have it or not. Medicare Part D, I could go on about the problems of that program for a long time. But I think that one of the things that is a telling point is that this was a program that was designed to promote for-profit pharmaceutical insurance companies. And the reason I say that is that the legislation that Congress passed explicitly forbade the United States government from negotiating pharmaceutical prices with pharmaceutical industries. So unlike Canada, we in this country cannot get discounted drugs. And I think that that's a very serious flaw in that legislation. And I can take another question now.
Okay. Well, there, yes, indeed, there we have at least one more, and the caller is in Savoy. It's line one. Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, hey, you know, one of the things I think everybody's missing the point on here is, you know, whenever you talk about insurance, you're talking about a risk pool. And with healthcare, there's, you know, you're talking continuous risk. In other words, you know, people are taking, you know, continuous risk from one day to the other in terms of, you know, what kind of situation might develop. There's an analogy to this, and it's called car insurance, liability insurance. And if you go and you look at what you pay, you would pay $300 or $400 a year for $500,000 of liability insurance on an automobile, which is in reality continuous risk. You use that car every day, you're exposed to that risk, and there's a very large pool to cover that risk. Basically, health insurance falls into this exact same category. And so if you go and you look at the price that you're paying for the same risk, these healthcare premiums are just out of sight. They're completely disconnected from the risk. And the only way to get around it is to bring back the 1950s insurance commissions.
Well, I guess my first response to you would be that automobile insurance companies spend far more on their administrative costs, a far greater percentage of their...
No, I'm talking about how much money you spend to buy the risk. I can spend $500 a year and buy $500,000 worth of risk.
Mm-hmm.
If you try and do that with a health insurance company, you might spend $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
You see the disconnect?
Well, I see the disconnect, yeah.
All right, risk is risk in terms of dollars. Whenever you're just talking, how much risk do you want to buy? Risk is risk. And this is where the real problem lies. They're not being regulated properly.
Well, I guess I have trouble answering that question, because I think that the big problem with health insurance is that so many people are not being able to buy health insurance because they can't afford it. And if what would happen if, in most states, everyone is required to purchase automobile insurance and have a collision and all these other things so that we're all protected if we're hit by someone else. In the healthcare field, we have 46.6 million people who don't have any care at all, and they're part of the problem that's driving up the cost of medical care.
We're to the point here where we're almost out of time. Maybe we have a couple of minutes left. Can you point to anything, because certainly the existence of the HMO has changed healthcare in this country substantially. It's changed the way that a lot of people think about healthcare and how it's delivered. It certainly changed the way a lot of people experience the delivery of their healthcare.
Yeah. I think that most people are happy with the doctors that they have. They're unhappy with the system. The universal health care program that I'm working on in Wisconsin would do away with the business of insurance companies and would actually save a great deal, at least 30% of our health care dollars by doing away with health care insurance companies, and also would do away with a lot of the other health care expenses that we have, because our doctors now spend a great deal of money on paperwork and calling insurance companies to advocate for their patients because the insurers don't want to provide certain services, or they have staff who have to decide what treatments a doctor can provide and what medications a doctor can provide because the patient has this policy or that policy. If we take all of those administration costs out of the health care costs, we would be able to reduce health care costs by about 50%, and we would be able to ensure everyone in Wisconsin, if you're working with Wisconsin, or we would be able to insure everyone in the United States for much less money than this country is spending now. And most people don't realize that 80% of the health care that's now provided in this country is paid for by our federal and state governments. And, people who say, well, we don't want to have the government control our health care, don't realize that the government controls 80% of our health care now. The government operates the Veterans Administration, which has turned out to provide some of the best health care in the country. People who are on Medicare are generally getting good medical care, and people who are on Medicaid are generally getting good care. I see no reason why we can't have a government program that promotes good managed care with evidence-based medicine that refuses to reimburse drugs and procedures that are unproven and unnecessary. And I think that we would end up with a much healthier country than we have now.
It seems that the difficulty, though, is making big, very large, sweeping changes, and that our willingness only goes as far as some people would say, nibbling away at the problem of high cost and lack of insurance at the edges. Do you think that there would ever be a point where there would be the willingness to actually do something really big in terms of changes?
It's the nibbling away and all the Band-Aids that are costing all the money. We have to get to the fundamental issues of saving all the money that we're spending on administrative costs now. Medicare costs only $2 to $4 per each health care dollar that's spent on providing Medicare services. The for-profit HMOs spend, 30% of their costs on administration. We're wasting half of the money that we're spending in this country now on for-profit administration and forcing our doctors and providers to do hordes and hordes of unnecessary paperwork.
We're going to have to stop there. We've just used our time. If you're interested in reading more on the subject, the book is The Rise and Fall of HMOs, An American Healthcare Revolution. It is published by the University of Wisconsin Press by our guest, Jan Coombs. She's a medical historian. She lives near Madison, Wisconsin. Ms. Coombs, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was very nice talking to you and your guest, David.